Okay, so let's just get right into this.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are looking at a stack of research today that is, honestly, it's a little bit confrontational.
Oh, it definitely is. It pulls no punches.
Right. It's the kind of material that looks you right in the eye and asks why you might be feeling miserable, even though, on paper, everything in your life is technically fine.
Yeah, to have you on today.
Yeah.
We are navigating what the source material refers to as the survival meaning paradox. And usually, when we talk about these two things, right, survival and meaning, we think of them as a hierarchy.
Like a checklist almost.
Exactly. Like you secure your survival, you get safe, and then naturally, meaning just sort of follows.
Right, it's the standard progression we're all taught. Get safe, get stable, then get happy. But the research we are parsing through today, it suggests that for a significant number of people, these two drives are actually at war with one another.
They are completely at odds. The core thesis here is that the mechanisms keeping us alive, I mean, our literal survival instincts, are often the exact same mechanisms that are killing our sense of aliveness.
That is just a terrifying thought, that our own operating system is basically working against our happiness.
It's an internal conflict by design.
There is a phrase in the opening of the text that really stuck with me. It describes the specific agony of being a social mammal.
Specific agony.
Eh.
It is such a striking phrase. And it's not just poetic either, it's biological.
So break that down for me, because usually when we talk about evolution, we talk about success.
Right.
Survival is the win condition. If you're breathing, you're winning.
Well, in a purely biological sense, yes. If you breathe, eat, and reproduce, you have won the evolutionary game.
You get the gold medal.
Right. But the research we're diving into today differentiates between biological success and psychological vitality. The source material points out that our brains are architected for the former, often at the direct expense of the latter.
Meaning we are optimized for safety, not for satisfaction.
Precisely. We are built to survive, not to be happy.
Okay, but I mean, we aren't running from lions anymore. We're paying mortgages, we're dealing with, office politics or traffic.
And that's exactly where the glitch occurs. The stack highlights that our threat detection systems, the amygdala, the autonomic nervous system, they haven't really updated their software to match our modern environment.
They're running on prehistoric code.
Exactly. They are still treating uncertainty as death. So this specific agony refers to a state where our survival instincts have become so efficient, so incredibly good at their job, that they are now suffocating the very meaning they were designed to protect.
It's like we've built a fortress that's so secure that we can't even breathe inside it.
That is the paradox.
Yeah.
We spend our entire lives trying to reach this place of safety, but once we get there, if those instincts don't dial back, we end up feeling dead inside. We're safe, but we're not alive.
So the mission of this deep dive is really to explore that specific feeling. If you are listening to this and you feel like you are surviving perfectly well, you're paying the bills, you're not in immediate danger, nothing is technically wrong, but you are struggling to actually feel alive, this is for you.
And I want to frame this carefully right from the start. Because when we feel that way, you know, empty, numb, stuck, we tend to blame ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. We think, what is wrong with me? Why am I not happy? I should be grateful.
Right. The guilt kicks in almost immediately.
It really does.
But the texts we are analyzing today suggest this isn't a personal feeling at all. It's not just about your feelings or your attitude, it is about the architecture of the struggle.
The architecture. I like that distinction a lot. It implies it's structural, not personal.
It is a structural issue. It's about how your brain processes safety versus connection. It's mechanical. So while your personal history, your collection of data, as the source calls it, is unique to you, the mechanism of how this struggle plays out is universal.
Almost everyone navigates this to some degree.
Everyone with a human brain, yes.
So let's get into the blueprint of this architecture. Let's look at the first major concept in our stack, which is this idea of the debt of protection, and specifically the metaphor of the internal security guard.
Yes, the internal security guard. This is a powerful image, but we need to understand it's also a stand-in for a very complex neural process called predictive coding.
Okay, let's keep it grounded in the metaphor first before we get too deep into the neuroscience. The source posits that everyone has this internal security guard living inside them. And what is its job?
Its sole function, its only KPI, is to keep you from getting hurt.
That's it.
That's it. It doesn't care about your happiness. It doesn't care if you have fun. It doesn't care if you fall in love or get that promotion or experience joy. It only cares about one thing: is the organism intact? is the heart beating.
It's basically the strictest bouncer imaginable.
Essentially, yes. And we have to appreciate that this security guard isn't evil. It's actually trying to help. But it treats the club of your life like a literal bunker.
So here is the universal issue the source describes. What happens to this security guard when a person has been kicked in the stomach enough times? And we are speaking metaphorically here, you know, emotional kicks, betrayals, failures, traumas.
Well, think about it logically. If you are a security guard and people keep slipping past you and punching your boss in the stomach, what do?
You tighten up security.
You tighten it up. Initially, maybe you just check IDs more carefully. You vet specific situations. You ask, is this person safe? Is this scenario risky?
You're vigilant, but you're still letting people in. You're just filtering.
Exactly. But if the kicks keep coming, if the pain continues despite your vetting process, the source says there's a shift. The security guard stops checking IDs.
It is not working.
Right. It realizes that checking IDs is too risky because sometimes a fake ID gets through. Filters fail. People lie. So what is the ultimate solution for perfect safety?
You just lock the front door.
You lock the front door. You stop vetting. You just bar the entrance entirely. No one comes in. Nothing comes in.
And that is the debt of protection, because now, yes, you are safe, the kicks to the stomach stop, but so does everything else.
That is the trade-off. And this leads to what the source calls being conditioned to behave vigilant.
I want to push on this idea of conditioned vigilance, though, because the source describes this person who is all around cautious. But how is that different from just being a responsible adult? Or how is that different from someone who just has generalized anxiety? Is there a distinction in the literature?
That is a crucial distinction. The source isn't necessarily describing a pathology like an anxiety disorder, though they can certainly overlap. They are describing a strategic adaptation to a specific data set.
A data set of pain.
A data set of kicks to the stomach, as the text vividly puts it. See, anxiety can sometimes be free-floating. It doesn't always have a clear origin. But this conditioned vigilance is a learned behavior based on cause and effect.
So the security guard isn't malfunctioning?
Not at all. The security guard isn't crazy. It is actually doing a great job based on the history of the building.
So if I've been fired 3 times or had 2 bad breakups, my security guard has evidence. He has the receipts.
Exactly. He's holding the clipboard saying, look, the last time we let someone in without a background check, the building almost burned down. So new policy, no one comes in.
Let's talk about what that looks like in daily life, because I don't think most people walk around actively thinking, I am currently behaving vigilantly. It feels way more subtle than that.
It is much more subtle. It manifests as a low-level, constant background hum of risk assessment. It's the person who checks the menu online before going to a restaurant, not because they are excited about the food, but because they need to know exactly what the environment will be.
Oh, wow. I feel called out. I definitely do that.
Many of us do. It's the person who drafts a text message 5 times before sending it, trying to predict every possible interpretation to ensure they don't get a negative reaction.
Editing and re-editing.
Yes. It's sitting near the exit in a crowded room. It's the default answer of no, or I'll think about it whenever a new opportunity arises.
Because it's efficient. It works. Mm. You avoid awkwardness. You avoid disappointment.
But here is the tragedy that the source highlights. By protecting yourself from pain so efficiently, you accidentally insulate yourself from new novel outcomes.
New novel outcomes. That sounds very scientific, but it's actually the stuff of life, isn't it?
It really is the stuff of life. And this is the crux of the argument. Meaning requires novelty. Meaning requires something different to happen today than what happened yesterday.
It requires a variable.
Exactly. Meaning is found in the surprise of a new connection, a new idea, a new experience.
But safety requires sameness.
Safety requires sameness. Safety loves prediction. Safety loves routine. Safety demands that today looks exactly like yesterday because yesterday didn't kill you.
So the better you are at safety,
the less access you have to the things that make life worth living. You have successfully created a life where nothing bad can happen, but by definition, nothing surprisingly good can happen either. You have engineered a flat line.
That is a chilling thought. A flat line is a straight line. It's stable, but it also means you're dead.
Metaphorically, yes.
Yeah.
And this connects directly to the next section of our deep dive, which is about how this feels from the inside. Because if you've locked the door and you're safe inside, you might expect to feel peaceful. But the source says, we don't feel peaceful. We feel suffocated.
This brings us to section 2, the suffocation of the baseline. And this part really resonated with me because it touches on the guilt we mentioned earlier.
The guilt is a huge component of this dynamic.
Right. So I'm looking at this and thinking, How many times have I thought or heard friends say, "Am I a bad person for not being happy with what I have?"
It's the classic modern malaise.
You look at your life. You have the basics. You have the survival metrics covered. You have parents or a support system. You have a job. You have a roof over your head. Society tells us, be grateful. You have made it. You are safe.
Society treats these survival metrics as the finish line. Like, congratulations, you reached the safe zone. Game over. You won. Why aren't you celebrating?
But you're not celebrating. You're sitting there feeling, what does the source say? Monotonous.
Monotonous. Bored. Restless.
And then you feel guilty for being restless because you think you're entitled. Like, oh, look at me complaining about my perfectly safe life.
But the expert in me and the source material we're looking at needs to correct this view immediately. This is not entitlement. This is biological reality. For a social mammal, survival is a floor, not a ceiling.
I love that. Say that again. Survival is a floor, not a ceiling.
Think about it architecturally.
Yeah.
If you build a house, you need a floor. You cannot live without a floor.
Obviously.
Right. If you are falling through the basement, you are in crisis mode. You need food, shelter, safety. But the floor is not the house. The floor is just what you stand on to build the rest of your life.
So when we treat survival as the goal, we are basically just standing on an empty slab of concrete and asking why we aren't having a house party.
Exactly. You are standing on the foundation, screaming, why am I cold?
Yeah.
Why is this boring? Well, because you haven't built the walls or the roof or brought in the art. You've just secured the perimeter.
So this feeling of things being monotonous in the safe zone, that's not a character flaw.
No. It is a distress signal. It is your brain screaming at you. The source calls it the starvation of the self.
That is heavy. Starvation of the self.
Think about it this way. If you give a working dog, like a border collie, a safe backyard and plenty of food, but you never give it a job or a ball to chase, what happens?
It destroys the furniture. It digs holes everywhere.
It gets neurotic. It spins in circles. Because safety isn't the goal of a border collie. Function is the goal. Engagement is the goal.
And we are the border collies in this scenario.
We are high-drive social mammals locked in a very comfortable kennel. And the guilt you feel, that's just society telling you that you should be happy to be in the kennel.
Which effectively gaslights you into staying there.
Correct. It forces you to suppress the very impulse that could save you. The impulse to go out and hunt for meaning. Your naturally vulnerable self is starving. And what does it feed on?
Meaning.
Yes, but where does meaning come from?
Based on the source, it comes from taking risks.
Correct. Meaning only comes from taking risks. Meaning comes from the unknown. Meaning comes from the possibility that things might go wrong, but they might also go wonderfully right. If you stay in the safe zone, where the security guard has locked the door, you are prohibiting the intake of the very nutrient yourself needs to survive.
You are starving in a pantry full of canned beans because you're afraid to go outside and hunt for fresh fruit.
That's a great way to put it. You have sustenance, but you don't have nourishment. And that is why the guilt is so misplaced. You aren't ungrateful. You are malnourished.
This reframing is so important. It completely changes the feeling from I'm bad to I'm hungry.
And hunger requires action. But, and here's the catch, action requires trust. And that leads us to the most destabilizing part of this whole dynamic.
Section 3, the broken compass, or the loss of self-trust.
This is the part that I think is the most painful to confront. Because we often talk about trust issues in terms of other people, like I don't trust him or I don't trust society.
Right. People have hurt me, so I don't trust people.
But the source argues that the real damage isn't that you stop trusting others. It's that you stop trusting your own detectors. You stop trusting your own selection software.
The software that helps you decide what is good and what is bad in the first place.
Exactly. Imagine you have a compass. And this compass is supposed to point north towards safety and good and south toward danger and bad. If you have been kicked in the stomach repeatedly, especially in situations where you thought you were safe.
Like, I thought this person was nice, but they hurt me. Or I thought this job was a dream, but it was an absolute nightmare.
Exactly. If that happens enough times, you start to look at your compass and say, this thing is broken. It told me north, but I walked north and fell into a pit.
So you completely lose faith in your ability to read the map.
You lose faith in your ability to discern a blessing from a curse. And if you cannot tell the difference between a blessing and a curse, what is the only logical survival move?
You just reject everything.
Reject everything. If I hand you a glass of liquid and you have lost the ability to tell if it's water or poison, you cannot drink it. Even if you are dying of thirst,
yeah.
You have to slap the glass out of my hand.
This explains the paralysis so perfectly. It explains why people get stuck.
It creates what the source calls the teeter you never land from.
But teeter, like a teeter-totter.
Yes, a permanent state of suspension.
Yeah.
You are teetering between, I want to move forward and I might die if I do.
Yeah.
So you just hover. You never land. You are constantly second-guessing every single opportunity.
Is this real? Is this a trick? Is this going to hurt me?
And the specific fear here, according to the source, is the fear of weaponization.
Weaponization, that's a strong word.
The fear that your vulnerability will be used against you. That if you show your soft spot, someone will stab it.
The source uses a really vivid animal metaphor here. The dog.
Yes, the dog metaphor. This is essential to understanding the physiology of trust.
Can you walk us through that?
Think about a dog. When a dog is truly comfortable, truly happy, and wants to play or receive love, what does it do?
It rolls over, it shows its belly.
It rolls on its back. It exposes its soft underbelly. Now, biologically, this is a massive risk. The underbelly is where the vital organs are. In a fight, exposing the belly is fatal. So rolling over is the ultimate sign of trust. It is saying, I am making myself vulnerable to you because I trust you will not hurt me. I trust that this exposure will lead to belly rubs, not a bite.
But if your compass is broken...
If your compass is broken, rolling on your back feels suicidal.
Because you don't know if the hand reaching out is going to pet you or hit you.
Precisely. And if you believe the compass is broken, you have to assume the hand will hit you. So you never roll over. You stay on your feet, growling, or you hide under the bed. You refuse to expose the underbelly.
And by refusing to roll over, you miss out on the belly rubs. You miss out on the love entirely.
You miss the connection. You are safe. No one can get to your soft spots. But you are untouched. You are unloved. You are isolated.
This is just tragic. It's a tragic logic. It makes perfect sense biologically, but it ruins your life emotionally.
It is the logic of survival applied to the domain of meaning. And it fails completely.
And it gets even trickier, doesn't it? Because it's not just about fear. It's about data. This brings us to section 4, the missing data fallacy. This feels like the engine room of the whole problem.
It is. This is where we get into the cognitive science side of things, specifically how the brain predicts the future.
So I'm thinking about the brain. We like to think we are these rational, spiritual beings. But the source reminds us the human brain is just a pattern recognition machine.
That is its primary function. It looks at the past to predict the future. In neuroscience, we often talk about the brain as a Bayesian inference machine.
Bayesian inference. Break that down for us in plain English.
It means your brain operates on probability. It builds a model of the world based on prior experiences. It calculates priors. If 100 out of 100 times opening up resulted in pain, your brain calculates the probability of a good outcome as statistically zero.
So let's look at the user profile for this deep dive. Let's say your collection of data, your history, is 100% stomach kicks.
Every time you tried to trust, you got hurt. Every time you rolled over, you got kicked.
Your data set is entirely negative.
Right. Now, imagine asking that brain to predict a good outcome.
It can't.
It literally can't. The source explains that if you have zero data points for good outcomes, the brain treats the idea of a good outcome not just as unlikely, but as a scientific impossibility.
A scientific impossibility, like gravity suddenly reversing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not that the person is being pessimistic. It's that they're being a good data analyst. They're looking at their spreadsheet, and the column for good outcomes is completely empty. So when a well-meaning friend says, hey, just put yourself out there, maybe this time it'll work out, they look at you like you're crazy.
Because to them, it's not a calculated risk. It's a blind gamble.
It's a blind gamble. And this is why forward momentum feels so terrifying to the listener we are profiling. Moving forward requires assuming that the future might be different from the past. But their data says the future is always a repetition of the past.
The source uses a phrase here that gave me chills. It says, asking someone to have hope in this state is like asking them to believe in a ghost.
Believe in a ghost. That's the key image.
Because a ghost is something people talk about, but you've never seen.
You've heard stories. Other people say, oh, love is real, or success is possible, or safety can actually feel good. But if you have never experienced it yourself, if it's never been present in your life, then those concepts are ghosts to you. They are myths.
And we are asking them to bet their safety on a myth.
We are asking them to unlock the door, fire the security guard, and roll on their back. All for the sake of a ghost they have never seen.
No wonder they don't do it. From the outside, it looks like stubbornness. But from the inside.
From the inside of the architecture, hope looks like delusion. It looks like bad science.
So we have the locked door, we have the guilt of the floor, we have the broken compass, we have the missing data making hope look like a ghost. And if that wasn't enough, we have one final layer to this struggle. Section 5, sensitization.
The fire alarm.
Talk to me about sensitization, because this explains why the reaction to things often feels so out of proportion. I mean, we all know people who seem to explode over nothing.
Right. And usually we judge them for it. But sensitization is what happens to your nervous system when it has been in that high alert state for too long. The source uses the metaphor of a fire alarm.
Okay.
A normal fire alarm goes off when there's a fire. Significant smoke, heat, flames.
Right. That's a properly calibrated system.
But a sensitized system. It's a fire alarm that is so sensitive, so dialed up, that it goes off when someone lights a candle.
A birthday candle.
A birthday candle. A match. A toaster.
And the noise is the same.
The noise is the exact same. The panic is the same. The cortisol dump is the same. Your body prepares for a burning building, even though the threat is tiny. This is physiological kindling. The neurons are ready to fire at the slightest provocation.
And this is where the conflict with the outside world often happens. Because people on the outside, partners, friends, colleagues, they see the candle and they say, whoa, why are you freaking out? It's just a candle.
And they judge the reaction as unreasonable.
You're being dramatic. You're overreacting.
But the source and the expert view validates the reaction. It emphasizes that this person is not being unreasonable.
They aren't.
No, because they are operating on a history of fire.
A history of fire.
If your building has burned down 5 times, the smell of a match striking isn't just a smell. It is a precursor to disaster. To the listener, the candle doesn't look like a candle. It feels like a building about to collapse.
So the non-explicit behavior, the subtle things, a change in tone of voice, a delayed text message, a slightly furrowed brow, those are the candles.
Yes. To a secure person, a delayed text means they're busy. To a sensitized person, a delayed text means abandonment is imminent. The building is collapsing.
And because the alarm is so loud.
You can't hear anything else. You can't hear reason. You can't hear reassurance. You only hear the alarm.
And this connects us right back to the beginning, doesn't it? Back to the locked door.
It closes the loop perfectly. If your alarm keeps going off every time you open the door, even a crack, because the world is full of candles, what do?
You slam the door and lock it again?
Or you lock it because the noise is unbearable. And by locking the door, you prevent any new data from entering. You prevent the possibility of seeing that the candle was just a candle and not a fire.
So you never get to fix the broken compass.
You never get the new data points. You never see the ghost. You stay safe. You stay vigilant. And you stay starving for meaning.
Wow. That is, it's a trap. It's a self-perpetuating, perfectly designed biological trap.
It is. It's the architecture of the struggle. And recognizing that architecture is the first step. You have to understand the machine before you can dismantle it.
So let's zoom out. We've been deep in the weeds of the struggle. Let's try to summarize where we've been for you listening, just so we can hold this whole picture in our heads at once.
Sure. It's important to see the whole arc. We started with the security guard, the debt of protection. We realized that perfect safety requires sameness, which kills meaning.
And we looked at the baseline. The fact that survival is just the floor and feeling bad about only having the floor is actually a healthy signal that you need more.
Then we talked about the broken compass, the loss of self-trust that makes choosing impossible.
And the missing data. How hard it is to believe in ghosts when your spreadsheet is full of zeros.
And finally, sensitization. The fire alarm that keeps the door locked.
It's a lot. It really explains why just snapping out of it or just thinking positive is such useless advice for this specific struggle.
It is useless because it ignores the mechanism. You can't think your way out of a locked room. You have to unlock the door.
So for you listening who has been with us for this deep dive, who is nodding your head, maybe feeling seen for the first time, what is the final takeaway?
The final takeaway is compassion. You need to understand that feeling monotonous or unhappy in your safety is not a moral failing. It is a natural biological signal. It is your humanity trying to break through the concrete.
It's not that you're broken. It's that you're a social mammal in a cage you built for yourself.
A cage built to keep out predators, yes. But a cage nonetheless. And the hunger you feel is the sign that you are still alive enough to want to leave it.
And I want to leave you with a provocative thought, something to chew on after this deep dive ends.
Go for it.
We talked about the ghost. The idea that good outcomes feel like ghosts because of missing data, the source defines the problem, the architecture of the struggle. But it leaves us with a question. If the brain treats good outcomes as ghosts, because of missing data. The challenge is, how does one begin to collect new data when the security guard has locked the door?
Yeah, is that the question?
You can't get the data without opening the door, but you can't open the door without the data to prove it's safe.
It's a paradox.
It is. Yeah. And maybe the answer isn't to swing the door wide open. Maybe it's to install a peephole. Maybe it's to open it for 1 second. Maybe it's to realize that the ghost might actually be real, and the only way to prove it is to risk the haunting.
To risk the haunting. I like that. It suggests that the fear won't go away, but maybe the action can happen anyway.
We will leave you with that. Where are you standing in this architecture? And is your security guard ready to take a coffee break?
Even a 5-minute break.
Even 5 minutes. Thank you for diving deep with us.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.